And it says recording. So if anybody is listening this non-live, this is EN 410, and I'm finally remembering Craig Gilkey to record it. And we're going to begin with prayer. This is actually the prayer that I encountered in my morning devotion. It's actually on page 87 of For All the Saints, Volume 1. It's a powerful prayer here in the week of Advent 3. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
We pray. O thou whose name is love, who never turnest away from the cry of thy needy children, give ear to our prayer this morning. Make this a day of blessing for us, and make us a blessing to others. Keep all evil away from us. Preserve us from outward transgression and from secret sin. Help us to control our temper. May we check the first rising of anger or sullenness. If we meet with unkindness or ill treatment, give us that charity which suffereth long and beareth all things. Make us kind and gentle toward all, loving even to those who love us not. Let us live this day as if it were to be our last. O our God, show us the path that thou wouldst have us to follow. May we take no step that is not ordered by thee, and go nowhere except thou, Lord Jesus, go with us. Amen. All right, we are translating today Matthew 11. We have Bernau, Countryman, Leyenbauer, Peck, Volt, Attorney, and Woogazer. I mean, this is a cross-cultural group of names. I mean, what is Bernau? What is that, Josh? Is that
German?
Yeah. Okay. Well, Countryman is like Welsh
Gambian.
Or something, or what?
Gambian. No,
Gambian. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. 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 The Gambia. That's right. That's right. Okay. Clearly, some district presidents in the making among this group. And I mean that in every positive sense. Okay, well, guess what? Another paragraph in Matthew that we won't plumb the depths of. Are there any that we can? Maybe the genealogy. Oh, no, not even that. So both linguistically and theologically, this is a remarkable passage, which is why someone picked it. So why don't we start in the middle? Carl, would you give us a translation of verse 2, Matthew 11, verse 2, and then we'll kind of hack away at it.
And after John heard in prison the works of Christ, after sending through his disciples...
Dot, dot, dot. Go ahead and give us verse 3, I guess, Carl.
He said to him, "Are you the coming one, or another should we expect?"
Okay, good. So, Carl, it sounded like you took both these aorist participles, akousos and pemsos, temporally, right? That would certainly work. Did anybody else try a different translation? Troy, what'd you think?
That's right, because he had heard.
Because he had heard, that also makes sense to me, right? Would maybe give a little bit more of a, well, yeah, it would just give a stronger connection, perhaps, to what John heard and the consequent question that he sends. I was just going to mention that you don't, if you have a, like, these are two, what would you call it, asyndetic participles. That is, you don't have akousos, blah, 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 kai pemsos, blah, blah, blah. You just have akousos with what goes with it, and then pemsos. So asyndetic is one of those grammatical terms. It means that there's no connecting word, like a kai or something like that. The point is, they don't have to have exactly the same force, okay? So I do think that a temporal or a causal translation for akousos nestles well into the context. Pemsos could be taken the same way, temporally, or anybody got a different option on pemsos? I almost wanted to just take it as what Wallace calls attendant circumstances. So, after or because he had heard, he sent and said. Something like, because you kind of have to send to say if you're in prison. Say, like he didn't have a cell phone, right? So he had to send and say, so maybe the participle just piggybacks, as Dr. Veltz would say, on a pen. Yeah, Troy?
I was trying to make it, wondering if I could somehow make it more emphatic in sending, like he immediately sent. But I guess that has a chemical aspect if I say immediately.
Yeah, you would have to, well, you need an adverb, you know, or you might be able to get away with that if you were A, Dr. Vels, B, in a good mood, and C, had a present stem participle.
Okay.
Or something like that. So,
none of the above.
None of the above. Well, neither am I. And most importantly, it's an aorist stem, which is, you know, just kind of the default mode. So, yeah. So, again, the reason to do this is it's kind of like, well, it's because the New Testament is written in Greek. That's the reason why you do this, you know, and the closer you can get, the better, right? So, and different people can get closer and different people can't, and that's okay. Some people are counselors and some people are exegetes and some people don't even ever leave the Lutheran ghetto except like once every 4 days, like me. So, yes, Dan.
So if there were a connecting, were like a chi, or would they have to have the same force usually?
Nope, not even then.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mentioned that asyndetic thing because a well-known text where you have this is the Great Commission. See, baptizing, teaching, two participial constructions, and again, there's no connector word. And sometimes I've heard people try to make some significance of that. As far as I can tell, there's no significance whatsoever. It's just a stylistic thing. So, I mean, Matthew, I think throughout his narrative, just has participle, then another participle immediately. But then sometimes he'll have, you know, especially chi or maybe sometimes de. Yeah, so it's just the way he does it. Again, the basic rule of exegesis is if you want to find more meaning in a small feature, you have to do a lot of work. Right, so, and sometimes you do find things after doing a lot of work. Adam?
As far as dealing with
I thought you were volunteering to do a lot of work here.
No.
Okay. Just the regular amount is fine.
Dealing with the idea of preposition.
Yes, yes, through his disciples. Mm-hmm. Well, again, means is one of the things that Diopolis the genitive can express. So, yeah, in English, I think that's close enough for government work. Right, right. And we shouldn't be too married to automatically, woodenly translating every time exactly the same way. I don't think that would be off. Yeah. By the way, the variant reading is to, dua, right, I think, down there. I looked at it once. Sent two of his disciples, right? So, all right, and of course we'll come back to this and discuss this a bit next class period. But throughout history, and even to this day, people at times are uncomfortable with John actually having a genuine question. Right, and so the position is that he's sending, but it's really for the sake of his disciples. Grammatically, of course, there's absolutely no. Is that right? I don't think there's absolutely any support for this because John's a subject of the verb. He said. Right? Now he does say, shall we look? So maybe you could tweak it that way. Right? But we'll come back and discuss that. Grammatically, it's John asking a question, but he can't do it directly because he's in jail. Right? I think one of the ways you can read this text in English later on is, behold, those who wear soft clothing are in the king's house. But John's not in the king's house. He's in the king's prison. So what did you go out to see? Questions. Grammatical questions about 2 and 3. What do you call this kind of subjunctive? Let's see. I've already forgotten who translated. Carl, you did. I'm sorry. Shall we look for? What do you call that? Prostacomen, the subjunctive at the very end?
I don't know.
There's a name for it. Anybody? Right, it's the deliberative subjunctive, right? Yeah, it's the subjunctive verb in a main clause. Shall we, right? The other one is sometimes called, one of the others is sometimes called the bunny subjunctive. Let us do something. So. Get it? Let us. Yes. Okay. Are you the coming one? Oh, here's a good question. At least I think it's a good question. Carl, how do we know that you is the subject of this little linking verb clause and not ha erkamenos, other than it's first and that's the way we know it's supposed to be translated?
I think I just read them always, thinking always, but the pronoun is always.
It wins the subject battle, pronoun versus a noun. The pronoun wins the subject battle in a linking verb clause. That is correct. Yeah, so, you, are you the one who is coming, or shall we expect another? Okay. John seems to be having, understandably, some trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anything on 2 and 3 grammatically? Okay, verse 4. And maybe we could go ahead and get 5, 4 and 5. And Mark, would you do 4 and 5 for us, please?
And answering, Jesus said to him.
To them.
But to them.
Him in the sense of them, right? Good. I'm sorry.
Go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind see and the lame walk. Lepers are being healed. And the deaf hear. And the dead are raised. And the poor are preached good news.
Okay, good. So what do you want to do, or how would you label, Mark, in verse 4, this poruthentes, in terms of the participle? First of all, the referent is what? Masculine plural nominative. He said stealthily.
The disciples?
Well, yeah, strictly speaking.
Our choice?
No, it's got to be masculine plural nominative. It's the unexpressed subject of the main verb. That is, it's the you in apangelata. If it were there, it would be a masculine plural nominative you. Remember that the referent of a participle is always in the clause in which the participle stands. Right? This is extremely common. I call it the stealth referent. It's easier to say than if the referent is the unexpressed subject of the main verb. That's harder to say. So, right. Although Mike likes it when I say that. So he always gets a warm and fuzzy feeling about that. To John, which you hear and see. So, Mark, how about this little word, ha? What is that doing? What case is it, first of all? It's neuter plural. Could be one of two things.
Accusative.
It is indeed. And what's its case usage? That is to say, why is it accusative?
It is it's the accusative of direct object.
Correctamundo, of acuata and blepata, right. Relative pronouns, the case of a relative pronoun is determined by how it's functioning in its own clause. And here in this clause, it's the direct object. Right, very good. And then we have a bunch of more or less allusions, or not quite quotations, from Isaiah 29 and 35. Right. This is about the fourth item in. This is an interesting word, kophos. We have the plural kophoi here. Mark or anybody, what does kophos actually sort of most simply mean? It's an interesting word to me. Anybody? Well, it means blunt. But you can be blunt of different senses. So here, you know it's blunt of ear because it's paired with akuo. Okay. But you can actually also be blunt of tongue. See, I think once in Mark, a mute person is called kophos. Right? So it can apply. I just find that interesting. It can apply to different senses. So can we do that in English? We'd say hard of hearing. We wouldn't say hard of speaking. Is there an English way that would parallel that, you may think of? What?
Obtuse
of hearing, obtuse of speaking. What? Well, you could say that, yeah. Challenged, yeah. Yeah, that would be an illustration.
Impaired,
yeah. Hearing impaired, speech impaired. It would be like that, and it would just depend on the context in which it occurs. And we have some passive voice verbs, which I appreciated Mark translating as passives. So lepers are being cleansed. Dead people are being raised, and poor people are being good newsed, which is awkward in English. But, yep, good. Questions about 4 and 5. Any questions? Grammar or syntax? Mark.
And 5.
Yes?
So the present stems, just, is it the blind begins to see?
Begin to see, begin to walk, begin. Well, it would work with some of them. I'm not sure begin to be raised. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's possible. I don't know if you could actually, you know, strictly decide. Yeah, Russ?
Or, I mean, would it just be more of that present where it carries sort of that emphatic, like they are, you know, being made.
Right.
You know,
Right.
You know, like it really is happening.
It really is happening, yeah. Yeah. Somehow to express that, I think, is good. And that's why I think Luke actually brings this out explicitly, if I'm recalling right, when the parallel account in Luke is, it's like they show up, they're 15 feet away from Jesus, he sees them, and then he does a bunch of miracles. And then he says, go tell John what you literally, right now, are hearing and seeing, you know. So I think that kind of immediacy is definitely part of it. So it's a positive answer, and yet there's this odd caveat, you know, at the end in verse 6. Anthony, you had a comment? No? Yeah, Adam.
Would be our place to make it progressive, like something that's ongoing?
Our being, it's happening now. Yeah, continue to be. All those are possibilities. Again, sometimes it's just hard to know how firmly to fix on one over the other. Right. But present sim, indeed. Not have been, not were, are. Now it's happening. So again, it's a positive answer to John. That's one of the most basic things to say about Jesus' answer is it is a yes. Right? It's just that something doesn't look right here. It really doesn't. So to sound like Dr. Okamoto for a second. So yeah. Yep. Okay. Anything else on 4 and 5? All right, Josh, how about verse 6 for us, please?
And blessed is whoever might not be caused to stumble because of me. And after they came...
Oh, wait. We got to pause over 6, man. Yeah. Okay, so what's the subject of that clause? Do, 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 do. Anybody?
It's understood.
Oh, no, it's there. Yeah. Mark?
Oh, okay, well, I was going to say, it was the understood subject of scandalis.
Exactly, but it doesn't have to be understood. It's there. I see a nominative singular word. Hus. Right. Hus, the relative pronoun. Right. And it's paired with eon, which is really just on, but sometimes the New Testament writers use eon. So it's whoever. Right, and that's why you have the subjunctive, because it's kind of like what Vels' grammar calls a present general conditional sentence. So whoever is not caused to stumble, en emoi, is blessed. Right. I think maybe you shouldn't lean too hard on this. You know, scandalizo means to trip someone, to make them stumble, right? And this is passive, and I kind of like the idea of keeping its true passive transitive sense. So whoever is not caused to stumble. I think that works well here, given the use of scandalizo elsewhere in Matthew's gospel. Say, tonight you will all be caused to stumble, en emoi, Matthew 26, about verse 30. Exactly the same construction. The passive of scandalizo, en emoi. Even if I have to die with you, I mean, talk about irony. At this point, you need your irony boots because it's so deep, you know. Even if I have to die, I will not deny you. Yeah, right. Maybe the law could be summarized in with this statement. It's not about you. Not even a little bit? No, not at all. Right. So, if hus on or hus is the subject, then makarios is nominative, and it's the, anybody? Predicate nominative, very good. On the other side of the linking verb. And then we have to deal with en emoi. Remembering that en with the dative is very flexible. Extremely flexible. How might we translate this?
I translate it as on.
Yeah. I mean, that's traditionally how it's rendered, and you have lots of examples of this in Matthew and the New Testament. I think it works well. Because of me. Yeah. Probably not by me. See, that's possible grammatically, And that would be, you know, really deus absconditus or something. But probably here causal, as a causal force. Again, this phrase occurs with this combination of scandalizo in the passive with en emoi, occurs a couple times in Matthew. So that's kind of an odd little ending to Jesus' positive answer, isn't it? Yeah, sure, look at all this good stuff is happening. But blessed is this one. Again, blessed here is probably a very strong word, just as it is in the Beatitudes, right? So, because if you are caused to stumble because of Jesus, then you go to Gehenna, which is pretty bad, right? So, Gesundheit. All right, questions about verse 6? Thank you, Josh. Troy, would you give us... Oh, a question. Hokey smokers, two questions. I made the mistake of looking up. Pat, Mike.
Yeah. Is that the same word that Paul uses when he talks about...
Stumbling block?
Yeah,
it's the noun, a scandalon. But, yeah, we just heard it in chapel. Yep, same root. There it's the noun, this is the verb. Jesus in Matthew 16, I think, uses the noun, you're a scandalon to me. Is that right? Take a look. Yeah, scandalon e emu. You are my snare. That's what he says. It's not the kind of thing you want to have Jesus say to you. Yeah, you are my snare. That would be an objective genitive, I think. Not that you really care, but good, Mike. Go ahead.
Could you say some more about Gehenna?
Yeah. I think it is, and I don't really want to say anything about Gehenna right now because it's almost Christmas, and I want to get through the text, and we have a lot of tough grammar to go.
Okay.
But we will come back, remember, after Christmas, right? We'll come back to this very spot and try to plumb a little bit of its meaning, a little bit. Yeah. So, good question. The answer is, put it on hold, man, for a couple of weeks, and don't think about it even.
I don't want to think about it.
Good. Okay. Good.
He talks about it.
Yeah, he does. Right. Okay, Troy, would you give us verse, I don't know, 7, I guess.
Okay. As these, I guess, men were leaving, Jesus began to say to the crowds concerning John, what did you go into the wilderness to see? A reed being made to sway by the wind?
Okay, good. So what do we got? What kind of construction we got here at the beginning, Troy?
This, I think we have a genitive absolute.
I think you're right. Good. And by the way, just to review that, the genitive participle, because it's a verbal adjective, agrees with its referent in gender, number, and case. Right. So that's why when you're looking for the referent in a genitive absolute, it's usually snuggled up right there, and it's genitive plural. And here in this case, masculine. So as Troy suggested, I think he's right. These men, as these men were going, journeying, leaving, right? Jesus began to say to the crowds about John, what did you go out into the desert to see? Okay, I agree with that translation. let's see. You went out into the desert to see what? That would be the way you turn it around to make an indicative statement. So in that understanding, Troy, what's the function of that infinitive, theos astai?
I think it would be an object.
Well, you went out to see. Not
purpose?
Right, good,
yeah.
Purpose. Yeah, that's the way you do it. You just kind of do it and you say, oh, yeah, that's purpose. Right, okay. Now, in that case, what is the function of te? It's hard because it's a question. And Greek and especially English turns questions around.
That one, I think, is in the accusative case.
Right.
So
it would be the object of the infinitive. That is correct. Very good. Okay. And then why would kalamon be accusative? What did you got to see? It has to do with the fact that this is elliptical. It means Matthew has left something out or Jesus has left something out here. In answering the question fully, you would say what, Russ?
You went out to see a...
Exactly. You went out to see a kalamon. Right. And so te is accusative because it's literally the object of theosasthai, and if you repeated the whole thing, then kalaman would be the object of theosasthai. That makes sense? Yeah, okay. We have to make a decision. We don't have to, but we are going to make a decision on the participle, saliuamenon. There's no article on that referent or the participle, so we can go either way. What are you going to take, attributive or predicate position, Troy, on the participle? On saliuamenon. A reed while it is being shaken or something like that? Or?
No, I said being.
Yeah, that's what Vels... If Vels were here, he's not as nice a person as I am. He'd throw furry animals at you.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, yeah, right.
I
right,
like
right. Yeah, I, well, some of them.
In fact,
yeah.
If you want to bathe the dog, sit for
them. Yeah. We have... Paul Robinson says that squirrels are just rats with good PR. Isn't that a great quote? Yeah, he's right. Filthy little animals that chew through your gas lines. You could do it that way, but it's fairly easy to take it just as attributive adjectival. What kind of a reed? A reed which is being shaken. You could do it that way. Either way, I mean, you could make it work. The goal is maybe not to work any harder than you have to in Greek. I thought I'd get some snorts out of that. Yeah, sorry. Shaken by wind, almost as if wind is personified there, right? Because it's hippa plus the genitive. You could just use a dative of means, you know? That's kind of interesting. Yeah. Good. Here we have a funny little thing. You're thinking, yeah, this is all funny. I can't believe we're doing this much Greek the day before Christmas break. It's because we're pious, that's why. Somebody explain to me the variance in punctuation. What's the significance? We've got a raised colon after eremon, and we've got a raised colon with a one after theosasthai. What's going on there? This is editorial comment. Anybody know? No, it's a little more specific than that. They're saying that you can put a stop at either place. You could say... And the reason why this matters is because it changes, believe it or not, the way you translate te. Adam, you got a comment?
It changes from what to why.
Exactly. Yeah. If you stop after eremon, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, why did you go out into the desert? To see a wheat reed.
Exactly. Why did you go out to the desert? Question. To see a reed shaken by wind. Now, it doesn't change the meaning substantially, but it's a point of grammar. Okay. On the other hand, somebody's chuckling in their beer over there. If you take theosasthai with what precedes, then you translate it, what did you go out into the desert to see? Okay, now here's the point. So work with me here, and Tim and Pat, watch the windows. Don't let anybody go out. James, you're on your own in the corner there. If you break after eremon, then the translation is, why did you go out into the desert? But I want to know, on what account can you translate the accusative singular neuter of the interrogative pronoun, which means what, as why? And Carl is clearly enjoying this, and I'm glad at least one person is. Anybody got an idea? Pat?
Is that something you would consider?
No. Good guess? No. Yeah, Tim? Good guess. You may have seen on account of what, dia te, so dia plus the accusative means on account of. Believe it or not, what you've got going, Adam, got an idea? Exactly right. The neuter singular accusative can often act like an adverb. And when it does, it's labeled the, it's like the dative of respect. But you can do it with the accusative. So you translate, with respect to what? Okay? So now, whoever's listening to this online, you can't imagine the looks of rapt attention I'm getting here. That's right. If you hear the sound of mucus, That's eyeballs being sucked up into the backs of their heads. But I will not relent. Actually, this happens a fair amount. You get just an accusative noun or adjective or pronoun just flying in there. It's not the direct object. You don't know what to do with it, see? And the answer is you translate with respect to that accusative. And because this means what, and so that's why Tim's guess was very close, if you just translate with respect to what, that's the same as why. Okay? And that's how you're able actually to translate that. It's not because you're Orthodox Lutherans. It's because you know Greek grammar. Or at least I do. And Adam does, but he's a pastor and a PhD student. Although he's in Old Testament. So I think we should give him a hand for knowing that. That's right. So, all right. That's the last time we'll be nice to you. All right. So that finishes off, I think, grammatically, verse 7, unless there are questions. Pat, go ahead.
Which translation do you prefer?
I'm not sure, but why did you go out to see the prophet? See, again, I think it can actually go either way, which is why the edition has a punctuation variant. I don't think it changes the meaning really at all. It's just an opportunity to make you suffer, which is part of my calling. Vocatio. Yes, Mark?
The infinitive, the middle sense of it, the theos,
plus okay.
Would you insert what you yourself should see from there?
Oh, it's the easy answer. I think the verb's deponent.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's theaomai. Yep. So if anybody can gainsay that, please do, but I think it's deponent. Yeah. So, yep. So thank you for noticing, but it doesn't mean anything. Isn't that great? So, Mark?
Again, along the same lines, the verb before that, exhalate.
Yes?
Is that also deponent from exerkomai?
Actually, the only the first two principal parts are deponent.
Okay.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Yeah, it goes erkomai, elusomai, then aelthon.
Okay.
It's our friend aelthon, which goes to an active form. Right.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Sometimes I can't believe I know this stuff.
Somebody does.
Yeah. Well, it's okay. I guess it's my calling, yeah. Teaching elementary Greek is a lot of fun. It really is. It's a feeling of power. You have these students' lives in your hands. That's not true. All right. Any other questions? Good questions. Adam?
Do any of the deponents carry their
throughout? They probably do, and it would depend if they're middle deponent or passive deponent, right? So, and you can't tell in the first principal part, right? Because erkomai could be, you know, my is the middle passive ending, right? Yeah. Actually, when you can tell is whether or not it has a second principal part, oddly enough. Another fact that I know. Because remember that the second principal part can be future active or middle. So the very fact that you have erkomai elusomai tells you that erkomai is middle deponent, not passive. Because if it's passive deponent, there are no active or middle forms. Right? And so you couldn't have a second principal part. Right now I can't think of a verb like this. And Pat, who's supposed to be watching the window, is about to go out the window. So you can tell when his forehead turns red. Look, he's trying to hold it together. See, on the other hand, Bits doesn't actually care, but he's auditing, right? Is that right, Mike? Yeah, that's good. Good man. Okay. Cool. All right. This is good stuff. All right. Thank you for caring, or at least pretending. Anything else on verse 7? Verse 8. Let's see. How about Adam? Would you lead the way for us, please?
Rather, what did you come out to see? A man dressed in soft clothing? The ones wearing soft and clothing assumed are in king's houses of kings.
Right, right, as opposed to the prison of a king, right? Good. So we have the same, essentially the same grammar here in verse 8. Very similar. So we have, and again, I just think it's as easy to go with the way Adam and Troy, no, who was it? Troy? Yeah, Josh? Whoever. It's Friday. Translated last time. What did you go out to see? You went to see a man. Again, that's why anthropon is accusative, and you could take the participle aim fies menon as attributive position, modifying man, in soft clothing, soft things, literally those who bear or wear soft things are in the houses of kings. So pretty similar constructions. Any questions about that? Yes? Right. It applied to persons. It can refer to effeminate persons, right? And in Paul, I think at least once it refers to homosexuals. Yeah, right. Yep. Yeah, again, the flexibility of language, right? Yeah. So, yes, Pat? Good question. I don't think there's any difference at all, to be honest. Yeah, yeah. But it's not a bad question. I think I have looked sometime in my life at the way Matthew uses these two verbs. Hurrah was much more common. Yeah. Right, right. That's my sense, right? Again, if you want to find a difference in meaning and a fine distinction, you just have to do the word studies and try to track it out, right? There's a great example here. Oh, well, that'd take too long to explain, and we won't go there. So, but I promise it didn't have anything to do with deponency. So thank you, Adam, for translating you do looky. That was encouraging. Any questions about... sometimes I just do it, look. Yeah. I don't think it should be overlooked. Now, I was reading Francis' commentary. How does he do it? He actually has a different way of doing it. He wants to render it. Yeah, Mark, I see you've got it. Maybe in his translation of 11:8. He does look. Okay. I thought a couple times he did something like indeed, or I can't remember how he does it. Okay, great. Any other questions on verse 8? Okay, Anthony, how about verse... give us 9 and 10, if you would.
When did you go out to see prophet? Yes, I say to you, more than a prophet. This is he about whom it is written. Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you.
Okay, good. Thank you. So, again, a similar construct, the third question now. I wonder sometimes if it's innate to human language to do things in threes. And like, on your mark, get set, go. I mean, Jesus asks three questions here. See, I'm not, I don't think there's anything too profound about that. Well, he is, well, actually, he is a member of the Holy Trinity, but I'm not sure that's... as he was, is, Jesus is Trinitarian. But we could say that, but we should maybe, we should say it a little more strongly than that. Right. Anthony, what kind of word is parasoteron, other than a Greek word? I try to take away the easy answers.
Comparative?
It's a comparative adjective, yeah. A more abundant, or here it's, I think, typically rendered just greater, right? And then, what would you label the genitive case usage of prophetu? It's genitive. After a comparative adjective, it's the genitive of? Exactly, yeah, right. Again, there's just genitives, right? The only time you have a genitive of comparison is when you have a genitive modifier after a comparative adjective. So you don't actually have a genitive of comparison. You just have a genitive modifier after a comparative adjective. But that's hard to say. So you have this category, the genitive of comparison. So, right. I love it, but you can't take it too seriously. This is concerning whom it stands written. It has been and is written. And now the citation, mostly from Malachi 3, perhaps also from Exodus 23. Looky, I am sending my angel, my messenger, before your face. Note that John here is called an angelos. Who will prepare the way of you before you? All kinds of stuff going on there. All kinds of stuff going on everywhere. Jesus, to make the story short, Jesus gets put in the place of Yahweh in this quote. In the Old Testament, it's Yahweh's way. Now it's Jesus' way. guess what Jesus is? Trinitarian. Right. Right. Exactly. So, grammatically, any questions about 9 and 10? Yeah. Russ?
Is there a reason why the editor didn't give us options on the punctuation in the first 9?
Probably because they forgot. I don't know why they didn't give us an option. That's a good question.
I was going to say, because if there was a reason, then you might say that the other ones.
Yeah. I have no idea, because, yeah, we have the same thing with an accusative. I don't see anything. I think they got lazy. Yep, I think they got lazy. So, wie sagt man lazy auf Deutsch? A bunch of Germans did this. So. Anybody? Lazy? Light? No. Yeah, okay, yeah, that's, yeah, right, okay, fine. Good comment. Anything else on 9 and 10? Again, we've seen it before. Yeah, Eric and then Adam.
Who's the subject in the first half?
This one is? Are you asking about the antecedent of this?
Yeah.
I would say prophetu. A prophet. Right, which of course refers to John. Well, that's the closest thing I can see. Do you have another option? Or yeah. Yeah. No, no, I think personally, it's John. Grammatically, the antecedent would be prophet. Yeah, this. But notice it's not enough to call John a prophet. That's not good enough. See, that's part of the teaching of this, is if you only think John is a prophet, that won't cut it. Just like when the crowds cry out in Matthew 21, this is the prophet Jesus from Nazareth. That, well, there's a sense in which that's true, but it's not a happy sense. Because if all you think he's a prophet, then he will be a prophet of judgment. It's not enough to know Jesus as a prophet, at least not in Matthew. Luke has a more positive prophet Christology, I think. And Dr. Just's commentary, by the way, does a nice job of bringing that out. Adam?
I noticed you didn't bring up any emphasis much with the ego.
Mm-hmm. But it is emphatic, yes. Yep, I think so. Yep, I am sending my messenger. Good. Mark? This is concerning whom it is written. Yeah.
Is that odd to see just a preposition that is not ending?
Tell me if this is answering your question. I think it's the problem with the relative pronoun, because Greek routinely omits the antecedent of the relative pronoun. What you want to see, and what we do in good English, we say, this is he concerning whom, right? But Greek routinely omits the he. It omits it. It did it back up in verse 4, see? And answering, Jesus said to them, journeying, announce to John the things which, see? But it just leaves out tauta or something like that. So if it's feeling awkward, it's because Greek has omitted the antecedent of the relative pronoun. Yeah, you're right. Right. Or before, somewhere in there. Right. Nope, it has omitted the antecedent. It does it very, very often. Actually, believe it or not, as I like to say, this is one of the reasons why Dr. Vels' grammar should be called not so fundamental Greek grammar, because this point is actually in there. So, Adam. Yeah, no, I'm serious. In the chapter on the relative pronoun. Which I think is 15. But go ahead. He would know the page. Adam.
Can we put it in? Or is that...
In brackets. Yeah. If you're doing this text, right. In brackets. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Well, and it's a question of the receptor language. You want to make it good English. Right. Yep.
When it's not there, you have to put it in English.
I think our translations typically... Have we got an English translation handy? What's this? What do you got, Luke?
Or, behold, I send my messenger before your face.
Just a little before then.
This is he of whom it is written.
See, this is he. They actually supply it. And that's what we want instinctively. It's there. The Greeks just will leave out as much as they possibly can. Right? You guys know this proverb? I think this is the...
I think it's... Hmm.
Mathos is suffering. This is the dative singular. And Mathos means learning, nominative singular. This is actually a sentence. There is learning by means of suffering. But so you can leave out everything except just the subject and the dative of means. And I thought, you know, given the looks on your faces, you might appreciate that. Mathe Mathos. You can quote that to your confirmation students. When yes, you are asking them to memorize at least parts of the catechism. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Good luck. The parents, the baby boomer parents, might actually give you more resistance than the kids. So. I felt, no, never mind, that's another story. Anything on 9 and 10? No. We got to get to Beadzatai for crying out loud. 11. Let's see. Are we back to Carl, I think? Maybe? No, Anthony. Did you? You did already, right? Did you translate? That's what I thought. I'm losing track. Carl, get us started again, man. 11.
Truly I say to you, one has not been born of, no, one has not arisen among the ones born of women, greater than John the Baptist, but the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than him.
Okay, good. This is a little awkward. Egegertai. Parse that for me, Carl, at first.
That's from Egero.
Yep.
And it is perfect, passive, indicative.
Yep. And then the tie is third singular, right? Yeah, good. Perfect, passive, indicative. What's the subject? It's awkward, that's why I ask.
I guess that would be, well, it's the one who's...
Well, actually, it's there.
Is it there?
Yeah. I suspect you started to say it.
Well...
It's... Anybody? It's maidzone. Yeah, see, a greater than John the Baptist has not arisen among those having been born of women. Yeah, exactly. A greater than John the Baptist has not arisen. That's the basic clause. Right? And maidzone is a nasty form because it's the comparative of what? Do you remember, Carl? It's very irregular. It's like good and better in English. How many letters do good and better have in common? The answer, none. This at least they have a couple of letters in common. It's from, anybody? Megas. Big, great. Megas, maidzone, megistos. This is actually the comparative of megas, and we see it a couple times, right? So, so a greater thing. It's an adjective, and you'd have to take maidzone as a substantive here. You know, one greater, and then we have the genitive of comparison, right? Than John, comma, the baptizer, has not arisen among the born ones of women. Right? Okay? Makes sense? But, the, and then we have a mikrateros, another comparative, but here, normally taken not as comparative, but as, well, it's a substantive, it's got the article, but as superlative. Literally, it means the smaller or the lesser. But this happens fairly routinely in the New Testament, where even though it literally means smaller or lesser, you translate it smallest or least. See, like good, better, best. Small, smaller, smallest. But by the way, for those of you that care, on a Friday morning, at least it's not in the afternoon, right? At least it's not snowing, and you're wondering if you're going to get on the road and get stuck, right? Good is the positive adjective. Better is the comparative. Best is the superlative. So positive, comparative, superlative. That's the nomenclature that you see in the grammar. Mark? I'm not sure why he does that. I mean, it is a comparative. Yeah, right. Well, and the referent, who is Jesus talking about here, of course, is greatly discussed and debated, right? I mean, who is the mikrateros? And the church fathers all thought it was Jesus. Right? And I think that's probably wrong. But it's a very difficult passage. I mean, it's theologically, it's very difficult, it's very rich. Smart people have different opinions on him, on different things. So.
The church fathers saw it's Jesus?
Yes. Right, right. Yeah. You have to ask, well, in what sense is Jesus nekroteros? Sometimes they refer to his age. Sometimes they refer to his... I love this phrase, actually. You can't use it anymore because people... His divine condescension. You know, he condescends to lower himself and become smaller. Well, it's a difficult passage. Yeah. I don't think there's much sort of hardcore exegetical data to, because Mikros, when it's used mostly in the positive form, refers to disciples. And I think the key parallel passage here is Matthew 18, 1-5, where the disciples actually ask this question, who is the greater or maidzon, great head? There, by the way, there's a comparative used as a superlative, greatest in the reign of heaven. Jesus takes a little kid and says, unless you become like that, you don't even get in. So I think that's the key parallel here, but we'll do more of that. Yeah, we haven't even gotten to Beatitudes yet. Hokey smokers. Let's see. So the grammar, at least, is fairly good. Now in this last clause, now the subject is ha mikroteros, right? The least or lesser is, and then you've got to take maid's own. Now it's the predicate nominative, right? Is greater than he. That makes sense? Okay? Good. Anything else on verse 11? We're about to hit the really hard stuff. Okay, who's up? Mark, I think you're up. Yeah, good man. Okay, couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Give us a translation of verse...
But from the days of John the Baptist until now, the reign of heaven is beatified.
Hiding behind the Greek. That sounds like a cult film. Hiding behind the Greek. Okay, first part's not so bad. From the days of John the Baptist until now. And I think that's generally understood both in terms of Matthew's usage and in general to be inclusive. So the now is part of that time period, right? From the days of John the Baptist up to and including now, perhaps. The reign of the heavens, Matthew's favorite phrase, beatitai, okay? All right, now, Mark, do you want to explain this, or do you want me just to explain it? This is really complicated.
I think you'll do a better job than I.
Well, I probably will, but that's only because I do it for a living and you haven't had the chance. But if you have a chance, you do a good job, too. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right. Yeah, here's a handout. I just bring it with me.
Same son. This is actually the handout I used the last, so it's conceivable that you might have seen it, the day of exegetical reflection, what's going on during classes, so likely you haven't. But I happened to be working literally on this verse for this supposed commentary I'm supposedly writing.
So this is a handout on precisely this verse, Matthew 11:12. And no one can possibly remember this stuff very long, so I thought I'd give it to you in writing. And it's in the commentaries, although frustratingly sometimes they don't really pause to really lay out the data fully for you. They kind of give you the summary. So this lays it out a little bit. So just look at Roman numeral 1 there, the lexical consider. Is this okay if I just talk about this? You guys mind? Okay, all right. So beatitai, okay, you learned Greek, my a tai, right? Methesa untai. So tai can be middle or passive ending, right? So that's the basic problem lexically. Is beatitai present indicative middle, third singular, or is it present indicative passive, third singular? And of course, both forms occur. And the verb is not deponent, it's biadzo, okay, the active voice forms occur. So it's not a deponent verb, right? Although the active voice is rare, as I noted there. And by the way, I'm leaning on the lexica and, you know, the work of others and so forth here. We're always standing on the shoulders of others. So just the basic considerations. Biatzatai can parse as either middle, and it's more frequent, apparently, in Greek literature in the middle, than or passive. Rarely occurs in active voice. Now here's the deal. The middle voice can be transitive or intransitive. Remember that a transitive verb is simply one that can take a direct object, right? It's an action that can be acted upon an object. Now, if it's transitive, a middle transitive means to inflict violence upon, to dominate, those are negative meanings, or constrain, which can have a positive sense, like you constrain Pat from going out the window or something like that, right? Overpower by force or to press hard. See? So it can bear, it's about bia and biazo and biastes. It's about force. It's about power. Most of the time the words have a negative connotation, but it's possible at times to have a positive one. Okay. Now I just checked this out. I was curious. So in the Septuagint, you have six occurrences that seem to be middle transitive, so you can find a direct object, and they have a positive sense, but they all mean urge or constrain someone, and there's the verses there. And then there are eight times where it has a negative force of force through, like force through a wall, or to, once I think, to force a woman in a negative sense, I think in a sexual sense, and to fight against, okay? So these are just possible meanings. So it can be middle transitive. Now, there's no object here in verse 12. So most people tend to take it not as middle, just because there is no object, they tend to take it not as, if they take it as middle, not as middle transitive, but as middle intransitive. Okay. And by the way, historically, Melanchthon is responsible for this view. Okay. He's, according to those who say, he's the first one to suggest this meaning in a positive sense. So anyway, intransitively, it can mean to gain an object by force, to use force, to act with violence, to use force. Again, often in a negative sense, and in the Septuagint, at least, there's only one example of the intransitive middle, and it means to break through in a negative sense. That's where the people are commanded to stay away from the mountain unless they break through and Yahweh destroy them at the foot of Mount Sinai. I think that's the reference there. So you don't want to break through like that. You're doing something you're not supposed to do, and you'll end up getting croaked, right? So given the lack of an accusative object here in this verse, scholarships, if you take it as middle, they take it as intransitive middle, okay? So that's if it's middle voice. Now, the passive voice can mean be violently treated, that should be oppressed, be hard-pressed, overpowered. And again, most often, there is, very often, according to those who've studied it, especially in Josephus, one guy's done a study of Josephus's use, very often a negative sense. In the Septuagint, I could only find one example of the passive voice. In Sirach 31:21, oddly enough, which means to be assaulted with food, and as a result, you have to vomit. So that was kind of a happy thing to find. I can't remember how to say vomit in Greek, but if someone could look that up and get back to us, that'd be great. So again, those are the options. Could be middle. If it's middle, it can have kind of positive or negative. It's probably intransitive. If it's passive, more likely to be negative. But again, that's the problem, is that different options are possible. Now, this next two, B and C, I think are also important because we've got several words going on in the same context here. Apparently, the noun biastes, which means a violent person, is not a common noun, and apparently it always has a negative sense. It doesn't mean forceful, like he's a forceful orator or something like that. It means violent, okay? Impetuous in the negative sense. Those who have studied it say there's no example of this noun meaning forceful in the positive sense. And then finally, the verb to snatch or seize, harpazo, can be positive or negative. The Spirit, for instance, I think it's in Acts 39, the Spirit snatches Philip away after talking to the Ethiopian eunuch. Now, that's a positive sentence, right? Or it's more commonly with a negative force, as it has in Matthew 12 and 13. And so the birds snatch it away, I think, the seed that's sown, thus frustrating the purposes of the sower. So, now, and D, I think, is also an important point. Studies examining the combination of words from these stems, studies by two scholars named Moore and Llewellyn, have shown that a combination of them would very likely yield a negative meaning. So it's really hard, as the NIV, anybody have the NIV? God bless the NIV, it's a great translation. Don't go around bashing it until you're asked to be on a Bible translation committee. Nevertheless, like all translations, it has problems. Anybody got the NIV of verse 12? Yeah, go ahead, Eric. What do you got?
From the days of John the Baptist, and now the kingdom of heaven has been forcefully advancing, and forceful men claim hold of them.
See, that's almost impossible. They actually take both clauses in a positive way. See, that's like, is Elvis alive on the moon? The answer is, yeah, maybe. I mean, really, it's really actually a very great surprise. There's probably some scholar that supports that. I've never seen a scholar support the NIV rendering, to be honest. Don Carson, interestingly, takes the first one positive and the second one negative. And I think that's more likely, although I think they should be taken in parallel, just given the way it's set up. Right. By the way, ESV, Luke, what do you got there? What's verse 12?
From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has suffered violence, and the violent take it by force.
Yeah. Any Flannery O'Connor fans here? The violent bear it away, I think, that short story. Bizarre and profound short story. I read Flannery O'Connor short story, and I thought two things. This is a profound writer who could teach me a lot. And the second thing was, no, I'm not going to read her anymore. I'm already depressed enough. All my kids like Flannery O'Connor, and my son-in-law really likes Flannery O'Connor. Go figure. Okay, so what are we going to do? Here's the history of interpretation. I'm just going to let you read that. In a very bizarre way, the Greek fathers ignore the first clause. They simply never cite it. And they understand the second clause in a negative way, but it's a call to ascetic behavior, to asceticism. See? The violent snatch it away, and you're supposed to be the violent person snatching away your sinful desires and your fleshly lusts. Thank you for, I saw about 8 sets of eyebrows go like this. What? I mean, I think it's a classic example of a verse being snatched, being harpazoed completely out of its context. I mean, it's unbelievable. So, God bless the Catholic scholars who do these studies, you know. You get a complete history of interpretation, you know. So you can just read what they said. And the scholar, Peter Cameron, did this. I think I have the book checked out. Not that you'd have time or interest in reading it. Okay, now, top of the page, and this is interesting because Chrysostom comes up, and he ends up influencing, apparently, the reformers, including Luther. The Latin fathers at time offered a similarly ascetic or parenetic reading, but they, at times, connected it historically, referring to the Gentiles snatching the kingdom away from the Jews. Again, the focus is apparently largely on the second clause. Chrysostom, however, takes 11:12b and the violent take it away, apparently to refer to all who approach the reign of heaven with earnestness of mind. Now, that's the English translation of Chrysostom's sermon on this text. And apparently this reading is the most influential ones among the reformers, including Luther. So you and I are supposed to be earnest in, you know, seizing the kingdom, okay? And there's a certain, it's kind of like, you know, don't look back after you've set your hand to the plow or something like that, probably. So, apparently the medieval period offers little new. In the point B now, in the Reformation and post-Reformation period, according to Cameron, Chrysostom's reading is the dominant one, but there are two new readings. Interestingly, Karlstadt and Melanchthon. Karlstadt suggests that the verse refers primarily to the scorn, derision, and hostility with which Jesus was met by his contemporaries. But I think that's right. And most modern interpreters have followed this reading. Apparently, Karl Stott is the first one to take both clauses negatively and to situate it in its historical setting. It's not a generic call to anything. Jesus is talking about what's going on in his ministry. Oh, and by the way, John is in prison. Elijah's in prison. The voice of Isaiah 40 is in prison. Are you the coming one? To sound like Dr. Okamoto, this doesn't look right. I thought this was the reign of heaven. Jesus says, it is. But blessed is he who is not caused to stumble because of me. We'll come back to that. Melanchthon is apparently the first one to take Beatzitai as middle with a positive sense. And other modern interpreters have followed him. So there's a contrast by that reading. On the one hand, the reign of heaven is forcibly advancing. On the other hand, violent men are snatching it away, something like that. And the modern period exhibits a variety of readings and no consensus. One should probably hold to, one should certainly hold to an opinion in an informed way and perhaps, always humbly. The rest of it is kind of a little bit of an argument for taking it precisely the way the ESV does. And I think not a few English translations go that way. That is, it's a negative statement. Jesus is saying, look, this is not a good situation, and this is why it doesn't look right. Because from the days of John until now, people like Herod, right, the kingdom of heaven are treating the reign of heaven like that. And the shocking thing is that it actually works. They can actually get away with doing it. See? You'd think that if it was the reign of God, that as soon as Herod arrested John, then God would have zapped Herod, right? I mean, this is the reign of God. He's the voice of Isaiah 40, blah, blah, blah. But the answer is no. Herod's got John in jail, and he's going to chop his head off. So, and Jesus is, the next verse is, to what shall I compare this generation? And he upbraids the cities of Chorazin and Bethsaida, and he says, because they refuse to repent. See? And then the next chapter, the Sabbath controversies, and they're going to decide to destroy him. From the days of John until now, the reign of heaven is being violently attacked. It actually, do you hear that sound of it nestling really nicely into its context? I think it works really well. So. Say again? I think it takes it like the ESV. Anybody have a King James on a laptop or something? What do we got? Anybody? Adam?
Suffered violence and violence by force.
Yeah, right. The one tweak I might make is to take that harpazus in a conative sense. Try to take it by force. See? Because ultimately God will win. Yeah. Continuative sense, something like that. Right. Present stem. Whoop-de-doo. That was all on verse 12. I mean, there's an entire dissertation written just on the history of the interpretation of verse 12. Okay, so greatly, greatly controversial. So, I hesitate to say this. Any questions? We have 10 minutes left. I think we're doing okay grammatically. And we will come back, right? So, all right. I have no idea who's next. Mark, good job. Thank you for that handout. And this is unfair. I thought to myself, I gave the guy this. I should have had you do like 2 to 11, and then 13 to 15, and then just say, I'll take verse 12. So, Josh, how about giving us verse 13, man?
For all the prophets and the law until John prophesied.
You know, just when you were hoping for a simple sentence, you got one, didn't you? That's not so bad, right? All the prophets and the law prophesied until John. See, John is interesting in this text. It's like one now. There's two eras, right? There's the era of prophecy and the era of fulfillment. Oh, is that important in Matthew? See, so you looked at one way. John is in the old era, right? See, the law and the prophets prophesied until John. See, another perspective from the days of John until now. See. So John, it's like John has one foot in each of the ages, the age of promise and anticipation, and now the age of fulfillment, which has begun in Christ. So there's a lot of stuff in this text. And this would really matter to somebody who was living in the first century, right? Especially a Jew who had actually been waiting, as opposed to some American that just can't wait to get to the mall. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So with what you just said about China having one foot in each, who really ushered in the age of fulfillment? Was it Jesus or was it John?
Well, actually, that's a very good question. It was Jesus with John as forerunner. I'd say it that way. You can't leave John out of the equation, right? So, for instance, you've already got fulfillment going on in chapter 1 and 2, right? Announcing the birth, conception of Jesus, and so forth. And we'll look at some of this next time. There's some amazing parallels. I mean, Jesus says what John says. You know, not just repent for the reign of heaven at hand, but brood of vipers, who warned you to flee? The axe is laid at the root of... I mean, Jesus repeats John's words. And Luke has this even more. And thus it is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness, John. So John the Baptizer is this colossus, really, that stands... I think as Americans, we think that when in the resurrection of the body, we'll just go up and say, huh, Adam, good to see you. Ah, Moses, hey, how's it going? You know? Oh, John the Baptist, good to see you, John. Hey, like that baptism, see? I don't know, but I'd like to almost think that I'd be tempted to worship John if I weren't in the presence of the Holy Trinity itself. I mean, there are people that God uses for unique purposes. Now, of course, John would say, don't worship me, worship God, just like the angel does in the apocalypse. But John, the baptizer, is unbelievably important. See, but we're so far away, and we're not waiting in the same way that they were in the first century, right? You can't leave John behind, right? Not in the economy of salvation that God actually accomplished. So that's a very good question. On Jordan's bank, the Baptist cried. Verse 14. Troy, are we to you?
I think so.
Okay, then.
If you are willing to receive it, he is Elijah, the one who is about to come.
Mm-hmm. Could you give me a Texas translation for that last Tom Mellon Erkestai?
One who's fixing.
That, thank you. The one who is fixing to come. That's right. No, that was well done. Yeah. Yes. Right. If you are willing to receive. See, isn't this an odd? I mean, this is not postmodernism, you make your own truth, but there's something about this whole deal that makes it hard to believe. I mean, he's Elijah, objectively, whether you like it or not. But this is something you have to be willing to receive. Why? Because it doesn't look right. That's why. Did John the Baptizer have a successful ministry? Well, it all depends on how you define. Right? See, I mean, this is... Well, I've already said this 80 times. This is really profound stuff. It may be the most theologically rich paragraph in the entire Gospel of Matthew. In terms of theology of the cross, hiddenness, eschatology, fulfillment, eyes of faith. I mean, all this stuff is all woven together in this one paragraph. So, which is why we're going to look at it some more. Troy.
Grammatically, the infinitive is that, or is this a result or purpose?
Dexasthai? The first one, you mean?
Yes.
Probably even easier than that. It's after thelo, I want, I am willing. And you'd probably just call it an object infinitive or complementary. Thelo kind of wants an infinitive. I am willing to see, I am willing to hear, I'm willing to receive. Right. Yeah, just call it that. And then we do have another emphatic pronoun, right? Autos, he himself, right, is Elijah. And here, I think Carl mentioned it once again, the pronoun wins the subject battle in the linking verb clause. So it's not Elijah is he, but he is Elijah, who is further modified with an attributive position, adjectival participle, right? The one who is about to come, and that would also probably, because Mello wants to take an infinitive, probably call it an object or a complementary infinitive. Right. Again, it's just labels, but you do learn things by being able to use them, and you encounter the labels in the literature, the commentaries. Okay? Questions about verse 14? And then we have verse 15. Let's see, I have no idea. Yes, Adam, and then if you'll do verse 15 after that. Yeah, great.
I actually took the Om Elam as a substantive, but going to the one.
Oh, okay. So Elijah, comma, the one who.
And then I had to add in his.
At least as I understand your good question, you're saying, is it just an adjective or is it a substantive itself in apposition? Yeah. Just because it's a little easier to take it as the former rather than the latter. I mean, in Greek as well. Yeah, just, you know, name, article, participle, you know. So I think if we had, and I don't think we do, but one could check this out. Notice the impersonal one. I'm not telling you to do it. Is hamelon, is that a common construction? Yeah. Again, don't do this unless you like get lots of free time and can't sleep at night. A stylistic move like proper name, article, participle. You know, does Matthew do that? I mean, that's the way you check these things out. And again, with computers, you can actually do this. I mean, you don't have to spend like 80 years just finding the data, so which is a good thing. So I can't. I certainly wouldn't say that you're taking it the way the second option you suggested, Adam, is impossible. It just strikes me as being working a little too hard in Greek, even. Right, Adam. An echo of Jesus, or an echo of...
Oh, an echo of that phrase.
Yeah, right. Yes, I think so. Yeah. So John is an eschatological figure, but the real message is that the reign of God is at hand in Jesus. Right. So there is Christology in here, even though the text, properly speaking, is about John. Again, and that actually gets to Pat's question. You can't separate John and Jesus. By the way, where does this show up? You've been reading Matthew. Where does this show up in Jerusalem, the Jerusalem days? See? By what authority do you do these things? I have a question for you. What does he say? The authority of John, was it from heaven or from men? See? Jesus knows. Really. So again, you can't really... And it's because we're probably so far away or something, so... So, almost, Adam, is it about Jesus or John? And, you know, yeah. In the first place, John. But are you the coming one at the beginning of the unit? Right? Yep. So. And again, it all presumes a worldview in which you're actually waiting for God to bust into the world and do stuff as king. If you don't have that worldview, this doesn't make any sense. You have to read this with an eschatological worldview, not just a, you know, Gnostic or something like that. And then verse 15, Adam, quickly for us.
The one ending here,
good. So we just have echo. Now we do have a substantive participle, so you're happy about that. And a pars ota for me, Adam, just for the heck of it. And it's case usage, he said, cheerfully. Of? You got it. It's the object of the participle, right? And the imperative, let the one who has ears hear, or go on hearing, or really hear. Whoop-de-doo, right? Well, we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Thanks a lot. I got a quiz for group number 3. I have a quiz.
Thank you.